You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting. Happy Friday. You know, we had 50 plus degree weather yesterday, beautiful day, and now I look out the window and we're getting snow. Jeez. Well, anyway, I don't think it's going to amount to much. I hope not, but you know, at what point are you finally over with this stuff? Jeez. That's New England for you. Literally, you can ski one day and swim the next, or vice versa. Anyway, guys, this is it for now, anyway, for a while. The last show, I can't believe it. Jeez. Over 10 years. Broadcasting and pretty much nonstop. There were a couple periods where, I don't know, a few months went by. At one point, I just wanted to take a break, so I wasn't in a hurry to get started up again when I left one network or one network folded or whatever. But, you know, it was just a matter of time before I finally said, got withdrawal symptoms and had to get back into it again. I think the longest was maybe 3 or 4 months or something. But usually, I wouldn't have a break. You know, if one network shut down or if I just simply left for whatever reason one network, I had something lined up right away, picked up where I left off. This time here, it's going to be a while. Certainly, it'll be a while before, you know, if I ever get a five-day show again. I don't know. Like I said, if I get back into it, it's probably just going to be one show a week or something. I don't know if I'm going to have time to do like I have been, you know, five shows a week, which stinks because it's been a very big part of my life, and I really enjoyed doing it. It's been as much of an education for me as it has been for my listeners. When you do radio, it forces you to more intensively research than you ordinarily would do. I'll still be researching. I'll always be doing that. I love it. But not on the same scale, you know, when you have a show and to intensify that research. But it's really paid off, you know, for me personally, like I said, as well as everybody else. I really learned a lot, not just from my own research, but of course from all the links I've been sent over the years by listeners, and thanks to all my listeners for that. Geez, I probably learned as much from my audience as I have on my own. I've gotten a lot of fresh ideas, stuff I hadn't even thought of. I've also gotten a lot of supplementary ideas to augment, you know, stuff I've already worked on that I wasn't aware of before. learned a lot of amazing stuff over the years. So it's been great. It's been quite a ride. There was one time where I actually was doing shows on, like, I think the most at one time was four networks back in my RBN days. When I was with RBN, originally I had, 5 day a week slot. That was also a morning show, although it wasn't quite so early. I think it was like 10 to noon or something. But anyway, I was doing that 5 days. And then I had a show I did on Sunday nights. I think there was another one on Saturday nights I did, and then I did another one on Tuesday nights. So that was like four, at least four shows, or four networks, I should say. I was doing more than four shows. I was doing like eight shows a week, but on four different networks. I think there was a fifth one that I kind of bounced around with too for a while. I did like guest hosting and But to me, I couldn't get enough of it. It wasn't a burden, And sometimes I would use the same material from like my RBN shows, I would use on the other network. Anyway. But and boy, have I come a long way since those days. When I started broadcasting, I basically wasn't even Jew-wise. I knew about, quote, Zionism. Oh, big deal. I mean, I can appreciate, a lot of the anti-Zionists out there. They are, most of them, sincere. Their reasons for being disgusted with the tribe, with Israel, I should say, are legitimate. But they don't realize just how deep that rat nest goes. They don't realize how long these scoundrels have been at this. A lot of anti-Zionists think it's just some modern phenomenon, that arose with Theodor Herzl. That's what I used to think. And of course, a lot of them are Bible dupes, and so they think that it's just these Ashkenazis and a few Sephardim here and there. But other than that, the original Jews, the heebie-jeebies, they were good, 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 good. Yeah. Oh, how good they were. Like the great godly man Joseph, who raped Egypt. Oh, what a godly, what a wonderful man he was. Like I said, guys, unless you can part ways with that book, recognizing it for the piece of garbage that it is, they have you by the gonads, baby. They got you. They got you. You can complain about the modern state of Israel all you want. Claim that you're wide awake. They have you. They have you. You might as well get a yarmulke and show up at the temple this week. They have you. So, if nothing else, with all my ramblings over the years, I hope I've driven that point home. And like I said, if anybody wants, drop me an email. It's still going to take a while for me to finish the book. As of last night, I finished the latest editing, but I can tell it still needs a lot more work. I got rid of most of the glitches, the repetitive words and phrases, and a lot of the spelling errors and punctuation problems, on and on and on. Made a lot of corrections, took out some sections that I not sections but some sentences, maybe a paragraph here or there that didn't make sense. I've also added some stuff too as I've gone along. But it needs even more refining. And that takes a while. Like I said, this is the most tedious, lengthy part of writing a book. It's the editing. It sucks. I hate it, but it's got to be done. So, you know, I got to go through this several more times, more intensively now, really, really concentrate. So, you know, I don't, like I said, I think it's probably another month, maybe 2 more months to really, really get it the way I want it. But in the meantime, if anybody wants, you know, drop me an email and I'll send you the thing in its current form. And, you know, maybe you can make some suggestions, things you think need to be changed. And don't expect it to be filled with my usual flavorful, you know, language that I use when I describe the book on my show. My approach when I write a book is completely different from, you know, how I present it verbally for several reasons. But when I write, I just want to maintain a, you know, a professional decorum, professional stance, you know. And I just want to deal with facts. Although I did start last night, I want to add some more to it, but I did add a conclusion section to it where I do go into somewhat into my, for the first time in the entire book, I talk in the first person and I do relate some of my story. I don't go into it in a lot of detail, just so people know. And I point out the reason I do that is because, yeah, I think it is important for people to realize that a book like this is being presented by someone who himself was a Bible dupe. That's important, especially for Bible dupes, because Bible dupes don't even think that's possible, most of them anyway. They don't think that you can actually have once known Jesus or what you thought was knowing Jesus and then leave the thing. They don't. In fact, their first response, if you tell them that you once knew Jesus, you know, and that you left the whole thing, their first response is to say, no, you really didn't know him. If you knew him, you wouldn't have left. Ah, whatever. Whatever. You could say that about a lot of marriages too, right? Oh, why? I knew that couple years ago. They were so much in love. I can't believe it. What happened? I didn't think that was possible. They must not really have been in love. Marriages end all the time when the couples were initially in love. They end for all kinds of reasons, don't they? What you think is impossible. Oh, it happens. It happens. And why does it happen? Well, just like with marriages breaking up, it happens for all kinds of reasons. Yes, some people leave their religion, abandon their holy book and their holy God, for wrong reasons. They might have some things go wrong for them in their life, and now they develop this rebellious attitude. They might still believe God exists, but they're mad at him. So now they're going to renounce their faith because they want to go out and have some fun, or what they think is fun. You know, they're going to go out and party, you know, get involved in all kinds of illicit relationships, gorge themselves in hedonism. Sorry, that's not, it's not only not the proper way to conduct yourself, it's not a good reason for leaving your beliefs. As a matter of fact, you're in jeopardy of running right back into the arms of that monstrosity in the sky after you've had your little fun and gotten that out of your system. That's actually what happened to me back in my teen days. You know, I became rebellious. So much so that, I mean, I didn't stop believing in the Bible. You know, in my mind, I still believed it to be true. But at that point, I just wanted to go out and have a good time. You know, I wanted to party. I felt that it was holding me back, and I became resentful against it. against the Bible, against God. And so I remember one time at a party, a friend of mine was cleaning out his closet or something, and he was looking in his closet for something. And, you know, we're all sitting around drinking, getting high, you know. I look over, and I see he had pulled a Bible out of the closet. You know, I'm like, oh, you're a Bible banger, huh? And he says, oh, knock it off. That thing's been around for ages. I forgot it was even in there, you know. So, anyway, I opened it up, and I'm mocking it, you know. I'm quoting from it and making fun of it, you know, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's cracking up, you know. And I'm like, well, that's enough of that. I'll just toss this out in the trash. And he says, yeah, yeah, go ahead. So I was about to, you know, I said that because I didn't want to toss in the trash if he didn't want me to do it, you know. But once he said, yeah, go ahead, I realized he didn't care about it. So as I'm about to toss it in the trash, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. In my mind, I'm thinking, wait, let's have some fun even more with this. So I like a dumbass, I used to smoke cigarettes back then. So I took my lit cigarette, opened the book back up, and I plunged it into one of the pages, you know. And I said a couple of times, and I said, hey, guys, look, this book is really holy now. Ha, 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 you know. But just to show you, that's what happened to me, you know, as a teen. I became the antithesis of what I once was. But like I said, you know, once I got that out of my system, I got a little older now. I got away from the partying and the wild lifestyle. I came back. I came back to Jesus, more stronger than ever. I even got, got rebaptized. I became a retread. So you see, if you leave the book for the wrong reason, you're in jeopardy of being ensnared by it again, and probably more strongly than you ever were before, because now you want to make up for those sins, right? So you're going to be closer to Jesus than ever. You're going to become more obnoxious in sharing your faith, spreading the toxin around. But yes, yes, Bible dupes, it is possible to know Jesus, whatever that means, and to leave. Yes, there are some who leave for the wrong reasons, but there are also those who leave for the right reasons. Just like there are marriages that break up for the wrong reason, there are marriages also that break up for the right reason, even though originally the couple was absolutely, totally once in love. When such a marriage breaks up for the right reason, the couple was in love because both or one of the partners was blissfully ignorant about the other partner and what kind of person he or she was. When such a marriage ends for the right reason, it's because one of them, or maybe both of them, wake up and realize they made a big mistake. You know, I'm never one for marriages ending, but there are some marriages that really do need to end. They're toxic. To stay in it would be foolish. Yeah, well, in a case, for example, where a wife is getting beaten. No, no. You don't stick with your partner if you're getting beaten, okay? You get the hell out as quick as you can. You might need some support, yeah. Very difficult to step out alone in a situation like that. Find a friend or a family member or something, but you got to get the hell out of that. Anyway, so it is with the Bible dupe. It is possible to love Jesus, to believe in the fictitious Sky Fairy, who was really nothing more than a first century insurrectionist. It is possible to have what you thought was a relationship with this fictitious character. Christians always use that term. Do you have a relationship, a personal relationship? How can you have a personal relationship with something that doesn't even exist? Or something that you can't see, hear, taste, touch, or smell. It's like your kid believing in his or her little make-believe friend. The relationship is only one-sided, isn't it? It just exists in the kid's mind. And so it is with the belief in the great Ya monster and his little junior insurrectionist. It's all in the mind of the believer. It's not real. It's not real. Anyway. Enough of that. But I hope over the years, guys, I've driven the point home. You got to leave that nonsense. You got to leave it behind. But make sure you leave it for the right reasons so that you'll never be sucked back into it again. Leave it because you recognize it for the vulgar collection of filth that it is. Lies, hypocrisy, character-destroying, moral-standard-destroying garbage. It is the absolute antithesis of everything it claims to be. It's not a moral book. It's not a book of encouragement, a book of hope. It's a book of discouragement. I spend quite a bit of time in my book pointing that out. It doesn't bring encouragement. It brings discouragement. How the hell can you get peace of mind from a book that in one instance tells you you can have eternal life in the land of bliss where there's no more sickness and sorrow and suffering? Will you be reunited with all your dead loved ones forever and ever and ever? And all you have to do to attain this wonderful gift is simply believe it. Wow, that seems easy enough. Hey, sign me up. I want a part of that. Sounds great. But yet, as you read deeper, you find passages such as what Peter wrote, stating that if the righteous scarcely be saved, what shall be the end of the ungodly? Oh, wait a minute. I thought it was easy to be saved. I just have to believe. Now I see the righteous are scarcely saved? Well, there goes my hopes right out the window there. Oh, it's loaded with crap like that. Which is why, again, like I said before, I had so many people over the years call me, guys, grown adults in tears. And I'll tell you right now, from my own experience, most Christians struggle with this. Some of them on a daily basis, others from time to time. Everything seems to be going fine, and suddenly something will happen, and they'll slip right back into that mode again of depression. Then things will seem to be okay again for a while. You know, back and forth, up and down, it's just a roller coaster ride. Most Christians, though, go through their entire experience like that. It's constant. It never stops. Up and down, up and down, up and down. They try so desperately to feel content. They even pretend to be happy. They'll go to church and put their fake smile on. But as soon as they leave, they wear the frown again. They're not happy. It's not doing anything for them. But they think that, well, I have to stick with it anyway because I don't want to be lost. So I'll go through the motions, but they struggle with that doubt. Whereas if they didn't have this phony belief system in the first place, they wouldn't be burdened like that. And every time they stumble, who doesn't stumble, right? Who doesn't slip up and do something, you know, they regret later? We do it on a daily basis, don't we? Because we're imperfect creatures. Or as the Bible would say, we all have a sinful nature. Ah, shut up, whatever, man. But my point is, we all screw up, right? And if you're a Bible dupe, even the most mild screw-up to you is a horrible thing that potentially wind you up in an eternal burning hell. And so every time you screw up, and you screw up all the time, it's a perpetual reminder that something is wrong. I don't have enough faith. God is upset with me. I don't have the Holy Spirit. I might not wind up in heaven. Oh, guys, it's so frickin' twisted. It's a mind screw. That's all it is. So, hey, you know, if you want to live that kind of life, Bible dupes, have at it and enjoy, you know, the stroke or heart attack you're going to suffer one day because of it. The stress you're bringing into your life, is it really worth it? Not to mention all the other damage it's doing to you and those around you. The way you distance yourself from the unbeliever, You live in your own little island with just a few other dupes like yourself that can help buttress your lies and convince you that what you're believing is true, when deep down inside you damn well know it's most likely not true. You just don't want to face up to it. You know how many times, guys, over the years, I've seen that with Bible dupes? I'll share stuff with them, and I know that it's putting doubt in their mind. I'm not trying to ruin their day. I'm trying to set them free from the bondage they're in. I can see from the expression on their face, they're not so filled with that arrogance, that confidence, that what they believe is the truth and what you're believing is a lie. I'm going to heaven, you're going to hell. I am righteous and you're a sinner. I can see that smirk of arrogance and you know, self-confidence. I can see it dissipating. I know that deep down inside, they either know or at least strongly suspect that what I've told them is correct and that their faith is a bunch of crap. But I also know in most cases they don't want to change. And so guess what happens? Hit that cricket sound effects button. You don't hear from them again. You don't hear from them again. So you can see that their claim to love the truth and want the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, is just BS. Just blowing smoke up your hind parts. They don't believe it themselves. But they're hoping by repeating it enough and getting others to believe it, that it'll make it look more believable to them, and they can continue to go through life comfortably believing something that they either know or at least suspect probably isn't true. The fact that they turn a deaf ear to those who have shown them that there's problems that can't be explained away, in and of itself shows that they really don't believe what they profess to believe. Again, guys, this is why they surround themselves most of the time with only fellow Bible believers. Most Bible dupes, most Christians, do not associate with those outside their little circle of fellow dupes. They only want their lies that they believe reinforced. They don't want to hear that, you know, they might be wrong. No. Anyway, guys, get back into our notes from yesterday when we get back to with us.
Immigration developing now across the whole of the European continent based on what you're seeing there in Germany?
This is a very good point, because immigration is the future. You cannot work and live in a globalized world, in the middle of the world, in Europe, without immigration.
So there's a second thing in that black box, an unrelenting stream of immigration, non-stop. Fewer than 50% of the people in America from then and on will be white European stock. That's not a bad thing. That's a source of our strength.
We'll be right back.
guys. Welcome back. So, yeah, let me get back into the notes here. But, again, let me strongly reinforce the point. Stay away from the Bible. Stay away from its Jew God, its Jew philosophy. And, guys, for the most part, you really have to stay away from the Jew followers of that book, whether or not they have Jew last names. They're all Jews, folks. You believe in that book, you're a Jew. There are a very small number of sincere believers in that book that don't know better. But they are a very small number. Just like there are some people in the tribe, I'm sure on this planet, there's got to be one or two anyway, that are sincere, that are decent. So you can't write them all off. Just like Bible believers, you know, non-Jewish Bible believers, Christians, there are some, one or two anyway. So you can't write them all off. But guys, just like most Jews, are absolute scum. I'm not talking just the high-level ones. A lot of the low-level ones are scum too. They are. They have that tribal loyalty mentality. Even if they're victims that are getting screwed by this system too, they still have a loyalty to it. And so it is with Christians. Most of them have that loyalty to that detestable bitch of a book and to their fellow Bible dupes and to their Jewish God. So much so that just like even the low-level Jews, guys, they'll turn on you at the drop of a dime. So it is with Bible dupes. They have the same mentality. Of course they do. They read the same book the Jews read. They think that they're special. They're chosen. They cry persecution all the time. Exactly like the Jews. They'll turn on you in an instant, guys. You think they're your friends. But when the moment arises, when they see that you're not a believer and that you're in fact antagonistic to their belief system, they'll pounce on you like a verminous beast. They'll do things to you that you never would have imagined possible before because of all their rhetoric, their talk about love and compassion. They're Jews, most of them. They are. They're Jews. Christians, for the most part, are Jews, ladies and gentlemen. They have the same exact philosophy. And they learned it from the Jew playbook. So, let me leave you with that message, too. You not only have to realize that that book is evil and stay the hell away from it, but watch out for Christians. Most of them, guys, watch out for them. I'm telling you. Watch out. As, what's his name on Saturday Night Live used to say, hear me now, believe me later. You might not believe me now. You might think I'm being a little too harsh or a little too critical. No. Oh, no, no. I'm telling you from firsthand experience. I've dealt with enough of them over the years. They really are unbelievably hateful, hypocritical SOBs. They're evil. All their talk about love and righteousness, don't ever fall for it. There are some, yes, that really do believe what they say and do practice it. But most of them, and I do mean most of them, they're not that way. Some are very good, much better than others, at playing the game and seem to be sincere. You'd be amazed to see how many of them actually are not sincere at all. And I hope you don't have that experience, but if the circumstances are right, you will see what I'm talking about. I hope you don't. my advice would just be to stay away from them altogether, and you won't have to worry about it. They're, because so many of them, such a high percentage of them, really are not what they profess to be. They don't have love at all, folks. It's all dogmatism. I'm right, you're wrong. I'm going to hell. I'm going to heaven, you're going to hell. I'm saved, you're lost. It's arrogance. And boy, their true colors really come out when, you know, they see that, okay, this guy, not only there's no turning him around, I can't convert him, but, you know, he's going to try to expose my faith and make me feel uncomfortable. I'm going to burn him. Absolutely despicable individuals. I have no use for them. As the years have gone on, I've grown to like them less and less, to the point now where I can say legitimately that I hate most of them. I hate them. Absolutely hate them. Every bit as much as your friendly neighborhood Jewish supremacist. I really make no distinction between the two of them. Like I said, if you don't believe me now, keep what I said in the back of your mind, please. Because if you don't believe what I'm saying now, of course you're going to continue to associate with these people. And they will burn you eventually. And when they do, I hope these words I'm sharing with you now will come back. And you'll remember, damn, I should have listened to him. He was right. Most Bible dupes, most Christians, let me state it once again, with the most strongest emphasis, most of them are raging pieces of shit. My last show, so I figured, why not? I'll violate my G rating. Last show for now, anyway. Raging pieces of shit, ladies and gentlemen. Watch out. I'm telling you, watch out. You think you're petting the kitten. It's a ravenous beast that will rip your frickin' head off at the first opportunity. Watch out! Watch out. You've been warned. Anyway, back to our notes from yesterday. Allegro, you know, the scholar that the now deceased Dead Sea Scrolls scholar, that, amongst other things, was attacked for bringing out the point that most Bible authors were obviously under the influence of hallucinogenic drugs. Covered that topic a while back. Anyway, he went on to explain the purpose of the Copper Scroll that we were talking about yesterday. Here's what he said. The Copper Scroll and its copy, or copies, were intended to tell the Jewish survivors of the war then raging, meaning the 70 AD uprising that led to the sacking of Jerusalem. Oh, wow, that must have been quite a sight. Those are the good old days. Oh, the good old days when people didn't put up with their crap. Where this sacred material, he said, lay buried so that if any should be found, it would never be desecrated by profane use. That's a term the tribe likes to use for the goyim. Yeah, well, the real profane scum, please stand up. It would, he said, also act as a guide to the recovery of the treasure. So that's what the purpose of the Copper Scroll or scrolls was. One of them has been found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it mentioned that there was another one in Jerusalem that gave even more details. Find that scroll, you'll find all the treasure, and not just the monetary treasures, but scrolls with important information, secrets that they stole over the centuries from all the nations they infiltrated. Oh, what must have been on those scrolls, or what is on those scrolls that are still probably extant, hidden away somewhere. I believe the Templars found them, folks. I believe they accomplished what they set out to do when they went to Jerusalem. And that they've been passed on generation after generation ever since. I'd venture to say that much of our modern technology might actually have stemmed from those scrolls. You know, if you read a lot of ancient texts, and I cover a lot of this in my book, An Alternative View of the Distant Past. If you haven't read that, just drop me an email. I'll send that to you. You know, RTF format. One of the things I cite in there is an ancient Chinese record that talks about the knowledge of flight. It describes how this Chinese emperor instructed one of his wise men, his, you know, what we would call technicians today, whatever, to build him a flying machine. And it describes how, yep, after it was built, he took him out on a ride, and he enjoyed the view of the, you know, the beautiful view of the countryside, blah, 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 blah. After they returned, it says he ordered, the architect that designed it and built it, he ordered him to have it destroyed. And why? Because he said, should this technology fall into the wrong hands, it could be devastating, because this beautiful instrument that can bring so much pleasure can also be used for great destructive purposes. Isn't that interesting? Look at modern times, guys. No sooner did you have the Wright brothers making their first test flights, within just a few years, 4 or 5 years, they were mass-producing them and using them for warfare, weren't they? Of course. Any new technology, that's the first primal application of the damn thing, isn't it? Oh, yeah, what a great world. The tribe sees to that. That's all they see. Anytime any new discoveries made, new technologies developed, they swoop down, steal it, and then exploit it for military purposes. To dominate, to control, to degrade society. Whereas otherwise, guys, if we weren't cursed with their wretched presence, we would have been able to use all of the great technological developments that we've come up with over the years for man's benefit. Imagine what a world it would be, how different it would be. We'd all be living comfortably. Wouldn't have to be working 40, 60, 80 hours a week just to barely scrape by. We'd all be living comfortably, and it would have plenty of leisure time to pursue our interests that could better our own lives personally and those around us. What a world it would be, guys. Our lifespans would be extended. Life would be more pleasurable in the meantime as we lived longer. Nobody would be going hungry. Oh, think of it. Think of it. Plenty of resources to go around in this world, guys. More than enough. More than enough to support a population 10 times the size of what we have now. They create the illusion of shortages to control you and to justify raising the cost of everything. Shortages of food, shortages of oil. On and on it goes. It's all BS. Every single bit of it. It's all lies. Oh, damn this world to hell, man. Anyway, back to the notes here. Did Hughes D. Payen and his men find these treasures and scrolls mentioned in the Copper Scroll? I'll argue, yes, they did. They must have, because in 1125, Hughes, Count of Champagne, suddenly renounced his titles in Champagne, sailed to Jerusalem, and put himself under the guiding hand of Hughes D. Payen. Why would he do that? Why would he leave his lofty position, step down, and sail off to Jerusalem to be under the tutelage, if you will, of Hughes D. Payen? Why would he do that? Because he knew that they were, in fact, uncovering the greatest treasures you know, from ages past. They were great, not because the tribe produced them. No, the tribe doesn't produce anything great, never has, never will. They were great because they were stolen from other cultures. The greatest treasures of history. Probably amongst those treasures, guys, were some of the most important Alexandrian scrolls. It's not just when it burnt down later in the, what was it, the 5th or 6th century, or 7th century, I think, the last. It was burned several times, and it was the tribe behind it every time. But they were robbing from those documents way back before the time of Christ. They had a lot of that stuff in their hands. They stole a lot of stuff from Babylon. And before that, from the Assyrians and the Egyptians. Centuries and centuries of thievery, stealing all of their great knowledge. They were hoarding it away. So, you know, I bet, guys, the Templars knew about this. It had been passed on from generation to generation. It probably... the knowledge of that treasure being there was passed on, but people probably had forgotten exactly where it was. So that's why the Templars needed that time, 9 years, to search for it. They knew it was there, and that it was just a matter of time before they found it. They must have begun. I'm sure that they secreted it away in several different places, not all together all at once. But the Templars must have hit pay dirt and found some of it. Word got back to Hughes, you know, Count of Champagne. And so he dropped everything and bolted right down there to be with him. He wanted to be part of the action, help them uncover, and also to benefit from, the discovery of more of these treasures. For this to have happened, for Hughes, Count of Champagne, to leave his post and head down there, there had to have been some major finds going on in Jerusalem. Perhaps all the accumulated looted treasures, again, centuries worth, from Egypt, Rome, Greece, Babylon, Persia, Assyria. Perhaps all that collective stolen booty was being uncovered at this time. And this is the treasure that the Templars made off with in 1307, when finally the royal and priestly bloodline stood up against them to snuff them out. They took off. We don't know what exactly was on that ship, but we do know that the heads of the Templar order took off on that ship loaded with treasures. Exactly what treasures were they? Well, we know they had made a lot of money, too, in Europe with their fraudulent fiat currency banking system, high usurious loans and whatnot. Sure, they had accumulated a lot of treasure from that. Oh, but I think a very big part of it, guys, was stuff that they took from Jerusalem. Anyway, one of the many titles that is believed to have been assigned to the Essenes in the New Testament is the scribes. That would only make sense because the Essenes apparently were the ones that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were scribes. They lived in that commune, and 24/7, that's what they did, copying scriptures. The Dead Sea Scrolls we have today are probably just a small fragment of what the original collection was. They probably had thousands and thousands of scrolls. In the New Testament, we find that the scribes were also one and the same with a group the Gospels refer to as the Herodians. In Mark 3, 1-6, for example, we find that the Pharisees and Herodians were plotting together on how to kill Christ. Well, yeah, because they saw him as an insurrectionist that was going to destabilize the system they had in place. They didn't want that. It was not only going to bring the Romans down on them, it was going to caused them ultimately to lose their job and probably get the temple destroyed. And sure enough, that's what happened because of insurrectionists like Jesus. So naturally, they were opposed to him and others like him and wanted to kill him before he got them killed. In Luke 6, 6 to 11, a parallel account to Mark 3, 1 to 6, we're told that it was the Pharisees and scribes that were doing this plotting against Christ. So as you can see, the scribes and the Herodians, if you compare these two passages, they're one and the same. And since the scribes and the Herodians are one and the same, and the scribes appear to be the Essenes, the ones who wrote the scrolls, then we can assume that they're all one and the same. I deal with this in my book, by the way, in a lot more detail. The Herodians, the scribes, the Essenes are all one and the same. Most scholars now believe that to be the case. And if you look at the evidence yourself, you'll see that, yeah, there's good reason to believe that. That's probably the case. Jesus was Essene trained. I mentioned that. No question. His whole life story played out exactly like an Essene would. Disappears until he's 12, then he's arguing theology in the temple, then he disappears until he's about 30. That's how the Essenes train. But he didn't just receive Essene training. In fact, probably part of his Essene training was to be sent up. Whether his rich Uncle Joe took him up there or not to Britain, the Essenes probably would have done that anyway, sent him up there as part of his education. So even though he was Essene trained, he parted ways with them. Or maybe more accurately, they parted ways with him. They wanted an uprising too, but not the way he was going about it. He differed with them in many ways, even doctrinally. Some of his doctrines he carried over from them. But, you know, like most insurrectionists, they branched off from whatever group they trained under initially, or learned from initially. Broke away and developed their own ideas and became ultra-radical. Sometimes simply just because they wanted all the power for themselves. Didn't want to share it with the group that they trained under, you know. They had that screw all of them attitude. Join me or, you know, you'll get snuffed out. Insurrectionism, guys, was all the rage in the first century in Judea. Some think it was just that war in 66 that led to the sacking of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Oh, hell no, no, no. Where'd you get that idea from? No, 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 no. They were going on all the time, both before and even after that. Anyway, according to Nehemiah 13:13, a scribe or a Essene named Zadok was appointed as treasurer of the storehouse. And according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes refer to themselves as sons of Zadok. So as we can see, Zadok, or the Zadokites, were in charge. Zadok himself was in charge, and then later his Zadokites, or Essenes, were in charge of the treasury storehouse. They had, and apparently always have had, a storehouse, a secret place where they hid all of their stolen treasures. They would have to, because they had a lot of enemies. Enemies that they made themselves because of their shenanigans, doing things back then just like they do today. Hell, they had enemies just simply because, if for no other reason, and there were many other reasons, but just based on the fact that they stole everything everywhere they went. So they had to have a place to secretly hoard away all of their stolen goods. No doubt, in 70 AD, a lot of their treasures that they kept out in the open in the temple, some of it was, you know, stolen gold that they melted down, like the seraphim above the, you know, Ark of the Covenant. That was all stolen gold. Everything they've ever had has been stolen. but some of it was not melted down. It was in its original form. That's what they kept hidden away. They couldn't display that publicly because people would recognize it as stolen goods, you see. But anyway, some of it they had to hide, you know, in wake of the seizure in 70 AD, in wake of the siege, I should say, you know, when the Romans surrounded Jerusalem. Some of it was hidden then, but it looks like, guys, they had been hiding this, a lot of their treasures, long before that. If you read the Copper Scroll, the translation of the Copper Scroll, it describes multiple hiding places in several locations in Jerusalem. Another reason the temple was needed a long time, they weren't just looking for one hoard, they were looking for multiple hoards. And some of this, again, was hidden away at the time of the siege in 70 AD. Some of it, guys, had been hidden for centuries prior to that time. Perhaps there's still some as yet undiscovered hidden treasure there. Anyway, so it was the Essenes, a.k.a. Herodians, scribes, Zadokites, who both wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls and secreted away this great treasure that, you know, the Templars apparently later found. Indeed, they had been the custodians of Jewish looted treasures since several centuries before the Christian era, the Essenes. We just saw that from, you know, little passage we just read about Zadok. Zadok, who was probably the original founder, the founding father of the Essenes, because they refer to themselves as Zadokites. And his job was to hide the treasure in the storehouse. So there you go. Apparently that was a tradition that he handed on to future generations. These scenes continued to do that. All right, guys, another short break. Be right back.
Israel. Is it really our greatest ally?
The USS Liberty?
The incessant spying?
The control of our politicians and police?
The attacks of September 11th?
The Zionist wars of aggression?
The blatant war crimes against innocent women and children?
The organ and human trafficking?
The safe haven for convicted child rapists?
Do we really need to keep going?
The time of Israeli influence over our country must come to an end.
AIPAC is where we will let them know we will not be their goyim slaves any longer. March 26th through the 28th, Washington, D.C.
Be there.
You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Before another moment goes by, I want to say this. I was planning on saying this at the end of the show, but knowing me, I'll get rambling and get distracted, and next thing you know, the show's over, and I won't get to it, so let me say this now. I just wanted to say thanks to Renegade, to Kyle, you know, for giving me this platform for the past year and a half. I really enjoyed it, and, you know, I look forward to hopefully working together again in the future at some point. Again, maybe not in the same capacity, 5 days a week, but when I can get things sorted out, I'm hoping to come back at some point. But in any case, yeah, it's been a great, what is it, year and a half, I think. Yeah. Excuse me. It was September of 2015. I started with Renegade. Did I say Oracle? I do that all the time. I get Renegade. I started with Renegade in September of 2015, so yeah, that's a year and a half ago. Pretty long time, but not my longest. My record, the network I was with the longest for the past 10 years was Oracle. That was, what, almost 3.5 years. But anyway, been you know, it's been a great year and a half. Couple bumps along the way with some of my obnoxious and very bad oversight on my part. But you know, it worked out. We ironed things out. I couldn't believe. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Back in, I think it was in August, I didn't know Kyle was the one that was calling in and making a comment. I wasn't really listening to the, you know, I was just in that mood for taking my frustrations out. And it's, I just thought it was some obnoxious caller, you know, heckling me or something. I actually blew up on Kyle. I couldn't believe it. I had never done anything like that and never would have had I known it was him. Anyway, but, you know, I'm glad that we were able to work that out and move beyond it. You know, everybody has disagreements, sometimes vehemently so. Sometimes those disagreements are not even intentional. Like I said, I wouldn't have gotten so heated had I known who I was talking to. But anyways, nevertheless, it's good when you can have disagreements like that in any relationship. And still, you know, that's how it's supposed to be. Sadly, though, in a lot of cases today, it's not that way. You know, a lot of couples break up over one stupid argument, and usually it's over something stupid that could and should have been worked out, you know, but there has to be a willingness on both ends. And sadly today, you don't see that. You know, there's a lot of divisiveness that goes on, and especially now, you know, we need to be banding together, guys. going to win this battle. Anyway, but you don't see that. You know, I see so many people, marriages breaking up or just boyfriend-girlfriend relationships going sour. Every time I turn around, I can't even think right now of one marriage relationship. Well, actually, there is one. Just one. I can only think of one marriage relationship that I know of personally right now that really is working. Every other one, as I think now, every single marriage relationship I know of, family, friends, it doesn't matter. They're all on the rocks. And one of the main reasons, guys, is just the stress of this world, the pressure that's put on people. Running through the rat maze, it drives you stark raving mad. You put a rat in a maze, that rat will go mad, won't it? It'll get frustrated and, it'll be violent. It'll want to lash out at you if you stick your hand in there because it's so frustrated. It can't get out of the maze. That's how people are today, guys. They're stuck in this rat maze, and they're ready to snap. And unfortunately, they wind up snapping at fellow rats who are trapped just like they are. They're not the problem. If we could harness that frustration and get all of our fellow rats, if you will, although we're not the rats, it's the ones trapping us that are the real rats, but you know what I'm saying. We get our fellow trapped critters to take that frustration and concentrate it where it needs to be concentrated. Oh boy, would things change for the better. But anyway, back to our notes. According to the narrative of the 20th degree of the ancient Scottish Rite, in 1140, one of the Templar lodges from Jerusalem traveled to Kilwinning, a small western seaport in Scotland. It's further stated that this group brought with them ancient documents to be stored in an abbey at Kilwinning, that is, Roslyn Chapel. Are these treasures and scrolls still hidden there, perhaps beneath the floor, beneath the floor tiles, where it's known that several subterranean vaults exist? I would argue that yes, definitely, at least some of it's there. I think some of it was also brought over here. All that treasure that was on that ship that is known to have taken off with Temple of Treasure. Yeah, I think a lot of it was brought here. But some of it undoubtedly, guys, is beneath Roslyn Chapel. Hidden in plain sight. That's their game. All of their lies are hidden in plain sight, aren't they? You can go back and watch the footage of the collapsing towers. How many millions have done it and don't see them for what they are? Look at them closely. You can see their fingerprints, guys. You can see the little handiwork. Look at the squibs. Or for that matter, never mind just the squibs. Just look at the rate of the collapses. Look how fast they came down. Look at all the dust. You're looking at controlled demolitions. There's no freaking doubt about it. It's in your face. I love it when they come out with the pancake theory. You got to be freaking kidding me. If there was a pancaking going on, guys, first of all, you couldn't even have that with all the struts, the way the buildings were designed. But nevertheless, to have simultaneous failures of all of the rivets, millions and millions of rivets all giving away at the same time. It's just ridiculous. But even if the pancaking was possible, it still wouldn't have played out the way that the buildings collapsed, because you would have had a slow buildup of momentum where one floor collapsed on another, and then another floor underneath that would collapse, and then, it would build up gradually. as more and more floors collapsed and more weight accumulated, the pace would pick up. But it wouldn't start falling at a rapid rate right from the beginning and continue at the same pace, boom, 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 all the way down, such that the building actually collapsed faster than the speed of frickin' gravity. So there you go, guys. You talk about hiding things in plain sight. Right in your face, you can see what they did to us on that day, but so few people actually see it, even though it's right in front of them. So it is with Rosslyn Chapel. How many people visit that place every year? And how many multiplied millions more who never have visited it, know about it, have read about it, have seen pictures of it, whatever? It's got the attention of millions of people, and yet right there under people's noses is probably some of the greatest treasures in the history of the world, stored right beneath the floors, floor tiles of that building. Stolen treasures, part of our heritage that we should have access to. And there's the SOBs, as always, hoarding it for themselves. Oh, guys, I'm telling you now, they are hiding a hell of a lot more secrets than what we're even aware of, who have been paying attention and aren't in comatose like the general public. They're hiding a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff. Anyway, let's look at some evidence of the Templars being privy to advanced knowledge, showing that, yes, indeed, they must have brought a lot of, not just gold and silver and whatnot, but a lot of important scrolls with a lot of important information back from Jerusalem. But anyway, before we do that, looks like we've got a call on the line here. Welcome to the show, caller.
Hey, Charlie, how's it going?
Hey, what's up, man?
I just thought I'd call in since it's the last show, I guess, for a while, and wanted to thank you for all the great shows. I guess I've been listening to you for about close to a year now. And, man, I used to think I knew my stuff, like, as far as conspiracy-type stuff. And, man, you really opened my eyes to a lot of things that I didn't know about. And every show has been interesting, man. I don't think I've ever listened to one of your shows where I was just like, oh, this is boring, and shut it off.
But, yeah, I've always endeavored to not only come up with unique topics, but to make sure that every point that I make in covering those topics has been unique. And I don't know, I've always had a good sniffer for finding, important information that other people miss. It's interesting because I do, as I mentioned before, I have a severe visual impairment, one that seems to be getting worse all the time. But it doesn't stop me from noticing things that most other people don't see. I remember one time I was with some friends and we're looking at some Christmas lights. It was at a Catholic shrine, actually. We went there just to walk around, just curious, And they both have really good eyesight. We're looking at this one set of lights in a tree. It was arranged so that it looked like a butterfly, right? I took one look at it and I says, guys, that's not a butterfly. Look at it. And they couldn't see what I was seeing. I'm like, take a look. Don't you see what that is? It's an owl. It's two eyes with the beak pointing, poking out at you. All of a sudden, they're like, oh, my God. And they said, wow, what an irony. You, who has the bad eyesight, noticed that, and we didn't even see it. I've always been able to do that. Even though I have, crap-ass eyesight, I seem to be able to. And sure enough, that's obviously what it was. The whole thing, as we walked through, was loaded with occultic symbolism. It's supposed to be a Catholic/Christian display for Christmas, loaded with occultism. But right there, as we first walked in, the first one we saw, it was obviously your little Bohemian Grove owl, Anyway, I've enjoyed it too. It really sucks that it has to be this way, but I don't really have a choice right now.
Yeah.
Glad you've enjoyed the show, though.
Oh, yeah, totally, man. If there was any damn justice in this screwed up world, man, you'd be you would be making the money that Alex Jones makes, and that fat bum would be out on the street. But, you know, since you know who controls the world right now.
Yeah, that's why he makes that money. They allow him to have that kind of an income and assist him with it because he's a great gatekeeper for them. That's how it works in this world. You get rewarded for lying, being a scumbag, a criminal. When you're a decent person, you get crapped all over from every direction. I've come to realize that. I've accepted it now as the norm. It's not shocking or disappointing anymore for me because that's just how it is. It's how it's always been.
Yep. But, hey, Charlie, I hope everything works out, man, and you get everything straightened out and, you know, looking forward to the book when it comes out.
Yeah, I can't wait to get that finished. Yeah, definitely. So, you know, keep in touch, and that goes for everybody listening. You know, keep in touch. You got my email, and I'll let you know when it's done. But like I said, in the meantime, if anybody wants, it's, you know, it's not done, but it's, you know, a lot more cleaned up than when it was when I first put my thoughts down on the screen. So, yeah, if anybody wants, just send a request. I'll send you the RTF document.
Cool, man. I know you're the type of guy, you're not going to put out anything that's half-assed, you know. I know you
right.
want to get...
No, I really want to get it just right before I send it off for printing. But,
all right,
hey, keep the faith, man.
You too, brother. And, you know, hopefully you'll be back, you know, before we know
it. Yeah, that's what I'm hoping.
All right, Charlie.
All right, man. Thanks for the call.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, take care, buddy. All right, guys. So, yeah, let's look at some evidence now of the Templars being privy to advanced knowledge to further show that, yeah, they did find some important stuff in Jerusalem. The Templars undoubtedly were in possession of knowledge that was being kept from the general public. And this knowledge undoubtedly, again, came from the scrolls uncovered in Jerusalem. And, of course, probably from the looted scrolls of the Alexandrian Library, you know, which were housed, some of them, in Jerusalem. Anyway, the Templars were known for their prowess as master builders, which is really where the name Masons, where the Masons got their name from. Oh, we're told that they grew out of the masonry guilds of the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages. Yeah, whatever. Masonry, although not necessarily called masonry, goes way back, guys, way back. Long before the time that they're said to have first emerged. The Templars really were a branch of masonry, and they were themselves masons. A lot of the secrets that they kept were the secrets of building massive stone structures that, you know, to the uneducated eye seem impossible to be able to stand at all, let alone stand for centuries on end. In their day, they were at the leading edge of architecture, having constructed the most majestic of Europe's cathedrals and other massive stone structures. It's interesting to note, for example, that the Scottish abbeys in Selkirk, Kelso, and in Kilwilling were built right at the time that the Templars returned from their initial excursion in Jerusalem. No sooner had they returned, and now these grand structures, like never before, are popping up all over the place. Where did they just suddenly happen to acquire this knowledge of building the way they did? Very advanced. Were these structures built utilizing techniques gleaned from scrolls found in Jerusalem, techniques that themselves were again, originally stolen from the great builders of the ancient world. Remember I talked about Coral Castle a while back. I think that was here on Renegade. I can't remember now. It turns out the guy who built Coral Castle was a tribesman, ladies and gentlemen. He actually took part in staging... I'm trying to remember where he was from now. I want to say Armenia, but no, I don't think it was... or Latvia. That's what it was. He staged a copycat revolution in Latvia that followed the same template as the Russian Revolution guys. Scumbag tribe member bastard. And to this day, people marvel, how did this guy do this? You know, those blocks weighed tons and tons and tons, and we're told that only him and one other guy moved them. His friend drove the truck that carried the stones from the quarry to the building site. But, you know, the architect of the whole thing single-handedly loaded and unloaded the stones. He would tell his friend, this is what his friend said, the truck driver, he outlived him, you know, he told the story later. He says, I don't know what his secret was because he would never tell me. He would always ask me to look the other way when he would load or unload a stone. And then as soon as he would tell me it was okay to turn my head back, I'd look and there was the stone loaded or unloaded. He balanced these stones with such precision that the multi-ton gate could be opened or closed with the touch of a finger. You can't do it anymore because over the years, there's been shifting and some erosion and whatnot, so that now the gate doesn't swing like it used to. But nevertheless, originally this multi-ton stone was set in place with no metal, no hinge, metal hinge, nothing. He just, you know, carved a groove in the stones themselves so that the thing would pivot, you know. Amazing. How did he do it? Obviously, he was privy to some pretty advanced Masonic know-how. He's a tribe member, guys, of course. They've taken these stolen secrets, and they're stolen. Stolen from the Goy, and they hoard them for themselves. They take our discovery, our innovations. Don't fall for the BS that they're able to do what they do because they're geniuses. Oh, please. They steal our genius. Even those among them that have been rated with high IQs, they don't produce anything original, guys. They never have. Even the geniuses among them aren't really geniuses. They certainly don't have creativity. Anyway, the Gothic style of construction began after the First Crusade, and thus the Templar excavations in Jerusalem. So there you go. These constructions involved huge vaulted ceilings and flying buttresses, allowing for thin walls and huge window spaces. You look at some of these buildings and, yeah, you wonder, how in the hell can they stand at all, let alone stand for so long? They seem so sturdy. They are sturdy, but yet they look so frail. Where did they get this? You don't just develop this in a vacuum overnight. Where did they get this technology that seemingly didn't exist prior to this time? It didn't, as far as the general public was concerned. Where did it just emerge out of nowhere? They got this information on how to build like this, guys, along with probably a lot of other stuff, from what they were finding in Jerusalem. John Oschendorf, a structural engineer and historian of architecture and construction at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is amazed by what the medieval guilds of stonemasons were able to achieve. He talked about the first time he stood on top of the vault of the chapel at King's College in Cambridge saying, quote, "You're standing 80 feet off the ground and a thin piece of stone. You can even feel small vibrations, and you can't help thinking, the nerve of those people. The chapel roof spans almost 50 feet, and yet the vaulting supporting the roof is only 4 inches thick, a similar relationship of length to thickness as that of an eggshell. These people developed a real science of construction to attain a high degree of stability. I'm simply in awe of the fact that we haven't surpassed it yet." This is an MIT engineer stating that he's amazed at what they were able to achieve. We haven't surpassed it yet. How did they do this? Where did they get this knowledge from? Don't take this for granted and think it's some simple thing. It's not. To do that, guys, is on a par with, you know, the modern development of the microchip. Seriously, that kind of ingenuity demands a very advanced knowledge of, you know, of physics, of a lot of sciences. The proper distribution of weight, knowing what, you know, what, how much weight can be withstood, and knowing how to push the limit to the very edge. How did they do this? Where did they come up with this seemingly out of nowhere? Anyway, we got a caller on the line. Welcome to the show, caller.
Hey, Charlie, I was wondering why you and Renegade Tribune,
what do you know?
And
right
the Stormfront Boys. I'm right wondering why all you people can't have an open
Truth
forum.
Threats Radio at AOL.com. Drop me an email today, and I'll send you my book.
Why can't you people have an open
did you
forum?
Take the email
where
down?
Why can't we have an open forum where we can see what you believe and how it stands up against other people? Because, you know, every time I try to make a comment on Renegade Tribune, on this Axaparoon moron, he doesn't allow comments. Now, what kind of a human being does not allow any
comments? Well, if it's from people like you, I can't blame him now, can you?
Oh, yeah. So, in other words, you can limit yourself. You can limit yourself to what comments you want and what you don't want, right?
All right. Here's the floor for you. What's your comment?
And my comment is, not one of you people, you're just like the Stormfront people, you can't have an open forum debate. You can't, because your words are there. Because your words are there, and people can see.
Open floor.
People can see how little you really know. And that's the bottom line. Man. You don't,
break,
you
folks,
don't believe in free speech. You're not even American, right. Man. You don't believe in free speech. And the Renegade Tribune is a bunch of losers. That's it. Thank you.
Here's Jewish professor Noel Ignatieff.
My concern is doing away with whiteness. Whiteness is a form of racial oppression, sure. The suggestion is that it is somehow possible to separate whiteness from oppression, and it is not. There can be no white race without the phenomenon of white supremacy. In the same way, if you abolish racial oppression, you do away with whiteness. Treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity.
Your views are fairly well received in academia.
Yes, they're legitimate. Not to say that everyone agrees, but sure. And the task is to bring this minority together in such a way that it makes it impossible for the legacy of whiteness to continue to reproduce itself.
right, guys, welcome back. You know, I told the guy to stay on. I said, I'll give you the floor. We got a break. And even now, numbnuts, if you want to call back, I'll give you the floor. You keep saying we don't give people the chance to speak. Call. I shut up. I was letting you talk, and you didn't even make a point. I said, make a point. Go ahead. Here's your opportunity. And all he did is complain. When I gave him the opportunity to make a point, he complained. While I'm giving him the opportunity, he complained that we don't give the opportunity. Oh, my God, man. I honestly, I think the guy must have eaten lead paint or something when he was a kid. There's got to be something wrong in his studio apartment. I don't know. Anyway, we got another call on the line. Welcome to the show, caller.
Charles?
Yeah.
Hi. That troll that just called you, he forgot to add into that how the tribe, which he's probably a member of, has just made Amazon, through their pressure tactics, not carry books about the Holohoax anymore. Michael Hoffman has sent out emails, and it was mentioned on somebody else that the pressure groups in this country and even the state of Israel has said you should not offer these books for sale because it's, quote, hate, unquote, speech.
Jeez.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Left and right, man, from every direction, a lot of places now that they're doing this. Google isn't carrying a lot of stuff anymore. YouTube, it's unbelievable,
they're panic,
man.
They're in panic mode because the truth is getting out about the whole hoax. And they're pulling out the stops. But you know what? It's not going to work. The internet is our savior.
Well, you know, actually, I almost hope they continue doing that, because the more they do it, the more people are going to see that, there is suppression going on. They do have something to hide.
Exactly. And their days are numbered.
I just found out last night Amazon has a product now called Alexa. Have you heard of this?
No.
It's this little desktop thing that sits by your computer. And it's always on. It's always listening. All you have to do is say Alexa, and it turns on. It lights up to let you know it hears you. And then, you know, you can ask it any question you want, kind of like Siri. But what it does is it reports everything back to the NSA. Well, of course, it doesn't matter. Everything you do is reported by NSA anyway. But this is just another avenue, because they figure you're more likely to spill the beans with something like this, you know, like researching or you know, stuff you want to inquire about. So I love it. This guy did a YouTube video and he's asking it, who do you work for, Alexa? I'm sorry, I cannot answer that question. Alexa, do you work for the NSA? I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
Well, anyway, funny. If people want to find books that are out of print or whatever, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's a website called Abe Books, abebooks.com, and I've gotten a lot of out-of-print books from the old days and stuff, so go there. Usually they're for like $3 or $4, and a lot of them are free shipping, abebooks.com. And Amazon is shooting themselves in the foot, okay? And but that troll that just called you, he was so transparent who he was and where he's coming from.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that Amazon has told people, they're even trying to, Google's trying to ban Alex Jones. Now, you know, I'm not a big fan of his, but he does say some things that are worthwhile. But the war is coming. The war is coming. And hey, Mr. Troll, where you're at, we got your number, buddy. And
there's something brewing. I'm telling you, the momentum is building. You can really see it.
And they're panicked. They're in a panic mode. They don't know what to do to stop it, and it can't be stopped. It just can't be stopped.
I think they really screwed up with 9/11. It's taken a while for the reverberations of that to kick in, but I think they realized they pushed it too far, too fast.
Yep.
And it's encouraging, because a lot of people, I mean, this whole Pizzagate thing too has really woken a lot of people up. And once they see things are that bad, that you got something like that going on, it's only natural that people are going to be driven to want to start looking into a lot of other things. Well, wait, if this is actually happening, it's got to be a lot worse than I imagined. Maybe these conspiracy nuts are right after all.
I don't know if you've mentioned this, but there's been 1,500 pedophile arrests at the state and local level.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Okay, and the mainstream media, which we know who controls that, hasn't talked about that in any substantive way. So,
right.
Yeah, there's something brewing.
What's sad, though, I want to see some big names, never mind the small local, you know. Sure, I want to see them go, too, but Jesus, man, go to the source, you know?
Yeah, you know, Podesta, all these guys, and of course, Soros is probably the man who is behind the blackmail of these people.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to do what I tell you, or I'm going to, you know, like Lindsey Graham, fairy boy. You know, I got pictures of you with young boys, mister. You're going to do what I tell you in the United States Senate.
Right.
And, but anyway, I'm gonna let you go. But I wanted to ask you a question for a future show. If you've not already talked about this, what can you tell me about the Gnostics? You know, Gnosticism and stuff is because I love your work on the unholy Bible.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, do you have any?
Well, essentially, they're a step above. You know. Mainstream churchianity. They did acknowledge that the great Yah monster is in fact a dragon. So you got to give them credit for that. But unfortunately, just like the modern New Age movement, they bring a lot of good stuff out, but it's a tribal creation.
Okay, because I've been reading John Lamb Lash's book, Not in His Image, and how the Gnostics and the pagans were, you know, essentially butchered and slaughtered by the so-called Christians.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, look at the Templars. There's, you know, that was a tribal creation, and yet they were slaughtered, too, or at least the lower-level ones.
Well, yeah, served their usefulness, you know, the tribe says, okay, we need to get rid of these guys. You know,
they've
done what we needed to do. They were our thugs, our street enforcers who collected our money, and now it's time to get rid of them. Yeah,
right.
Okay. So if you ever, you know, can do a show on the Gnostics and how things changed, you know, a couple hundred years in the common era, it'd be great.
Sure.
I love your work on the unholy Bible and that. It's I mean, you know what? And it not you didn't actually you what you did is kind of crystallize it in my mind, because as a teenager back in the 60s, sitting, having to go to Methodist church and suffer through these inane sermons, I realized then it was all bullspit. Okay,
yeah.
It's like, this is so stupid. This doesn't even make sense. And I was only 17 years old. Okay.
Yeah, you can sense it. You might not know the reasons, but you know it's just not right. It's just there's something very
something very wrong, screwy. Something disjointed. And so keep it up and. So I'll let you go and keep up the good work. I don't get to listen to you live every day for work reasons, but when I do, I love to call in and support you. So take care, my friend. I love you.
All right, thanks, man. Appreciate it. All right. Yeah, guys, I remember as a kid, I was born in a Catholic family. We were never really practicing Catholics, but I remember going to Catholic church. It's sad that I fell for the Protestant version of Christianity for so long, but I could definitely see something wasn't right with Catholicism. I never felt not even the illusion of warmth in a Catholic church, because it's so big, the high ceilings. It makes you feel so small and insignificant. You know, they do that on purpose. They want you to have that feeling of awe when you go in there. It's all pageantry. But it was a very cold feeling. It wasn't warm at all. And of course, the Catholic service, I guess to some degree it's changed now, but back then as a kid, especially, I wasn't alive then, but pre-Vatican II, it was in Latin all the time. So you couldn't even understand it. But I remember as a kid, it was a lot colder than what it is today. You didn't have this, you know, it wasn't personalized. You know what I mean? You felt like disconnected. The priest was high on a pedestal. You were down, as he looked down his nose at you, you know, you were at his feet, so to speak. That's gotten a little better, but yeah, I always sensed that something just wasn't right with the thing. I never I never liked it. I did, unfortunately, though, fall for the Protestant version, which to me at least had, on the surface anyway, more of a warmth to it, more interpersonal. There was more participatory involvement on the part of the laity, you know. But in the long run, guys, any difference between, you know, Catholicism, Protestantism, or even the branches of Protestantism that they've all split up into, in spite of all their seeming differences, sometimes vehement differences, they're arguing back and forth over points of doctrine. In the grander scheme of things, it's all the same crap. All the same crap. There's no difference. Anyway, back to our notes. A technology of this sort, again, this type of stone construction that doesn't, you know, look like these structures should be able to stand. It looks like they should collapse. How was all this weight supported by such thin pieces of stone? It simply doesn't spring up in a vacuum. Once again, this had to have come from somewhere. Where did it come from? These structures began to be built immediately after the Templars came back from Jerusalem. It doesn't take a genius to figure this out. Interestingly, in France, guilds of skilled artisans from this same period were known as compagnonages and were otherwise designated as Children of Solomon. Children of Solomon. Solomon's Temple. They were digging around the area of Solomon's Temple, which, of course, is where they hid a lot of this stuff. Undoubtedly, the scrolls found by the Templars must have contained some of the same information found in the Qumran scrolls in more modern times. We know this because of Dead Sea Scrolls documents such as the Manual of Discipline and the Community Rule, which describe rules of conduct for the Essenes that we now know the Templars had employed. For example, new recruits of both sects were required to pledge an oath to respect God and fellow members and to live according to the communal rule. Furthermore, the initiates of both groups were to bring, quote, all their mind, all their strength, and all of their wealth into the community of the sect. They followed the same exact principles the ancient Essenes did. They were to pledge humility and unquestioning obedience toward the leader. Oh, does this sound familiar? How many secret societies down through the centuries, guys, have followed the same template? Because it's been the tribe behind it all the time. The Templars didn't necessarily have to get this from scrolls they got in Jerusalem. This has always been the case with secret societies. Look at the freaking the Jesuits, guys. Blind obedience. So if the Pope says white is black, it is, said the Jew Alphonsus. What was his name? Ignatius de Loyola. Alphonsus de Liguori was another scoundrel. But anyway, Ignatius Loyola, guys, a freaking Jew. He founded the Jesuit order based on Kabbalistic teachings. He was a big-time Kabbalist. His his book, what is it called? Spiritual Exercises, is total Kabbalism. Total Kabbalistic occultism. Anyway, so they were to pledge humility and unquestioning obedience toward the leader of the order, the Templar leader, de Molay, and his successors later on. Well, he was supposedly the last leader, but he wasn't. The Templars continued on, guys. You could argue they never really disappeared, just like, you know, the Illuminati. It didn't exist in name after the Bavarian government kicked their butts, but it's still around, and it, you know, under a plethora of other different names, the goal is certainly still in place for world domination, isn't it? So even though there's not a group formally organized that we know of anyway, calling themselves the Knights Templar, come on, they still exist. Along, with practicing charity and mutual fairness toward one another, with an indissoluble bond, you know, all of this came from, well, not just the Essene, but came from all the tribes' secret societies down through the ages. Both groups also looked forward to the dawn of a, quote, new age. Yeah, this is your real new age movement for you right there. When, as the elect of God, quote unquote, they would be his agents in the destruction of the ungodly and the restoration of acceptable worship in a predicted purified temple served by a worthy priesthood. That's what they're seeking for today, guys, ultimately to rebuild the temple. You hear so much talk about it. Christians talk about it, of course, and they think that that's a good thing. Although some of them think it's going to be, some of them think it's going to be a bad thing, you know, because the 2 Thessalonians 2, where Paul says the Antichrist is going to sit in the temple of God. So they believe that it is going to be something God is behind. The temple is going to be God's temple, but the Antichrist is going to reign supreme. Oh, give me a break. Talk about chasing shadows. The Bible is their playbook, a 2,000-plus-year-old version of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. So if you see something that seems to be a fulfillment of Bible prophecy, then you might as well say that the protocols of the learned elders of Zion is also inspired by God, because almost everything foretold in that document has come to fruition over the ensuing decades since it first emerged publicly in 1905. You see my point? You're not dealing with fulfilled prophecy if it looks like something the Bible foretold is actually happening. They're following their age-old blueprint, damn it. Of course the Bible foretold a world system of government. Hell, you don't have to turn to the book of Revelation for that. Go back to the Old Testament. I will bring all nations before you. They will bow before you and lick the dust from the soles of your feet. That's not a freaking prophecy. They're telling you what their goal has always been, but selling it to you under the guise of their God being the author thereof, so that you'll accept it and think that it's a good thing. God foretold it. He's bringing it about. We might not like what the Jews are doing today, but this is part of God's plan, so we have to go along with it. You see how this book has benumbed you, Bible dupes? It has crippled you mentally so that you'll actually go along with their plan. It's also gotten you to think that, oh, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, so that you won't do anything to rise up against this corrupt bitch of a system. You actually sit back and let it happen because you think it's part of God's plan. In fact, you're not to do anything because that would be to interfere with God's plan, and you don't want to do that now. Just where they want you. They're all too happy you believe in that book. They want you to believe in it. Initially, the Jews didn't want Gentile converts, right? Gentiles were unclean. But as time went on, they began to see the wisdom of Paul. Jesus, he had it right. Look at how successful this is. My God, there's more Gentiles falling for this than there are Jews. We can really use their help. We're going to continue with this thing. Wow, we can really exploit this. We can use these people so easily to do our bidding. That's what they've done ever since. And when Christianity wasn't taken off in the Arab world like they wanted, we'll make up another religion tailored to the Arabs, but still be a branch of our religion. It'll be based on our book. Fair enough. It worked, didn't it? And lo and behold, now to this day, what do you got? A freaking billion people around the world falling for that religion too? Holy horse crap, guys. I haven't spent much time, you know, talking about Islam as I have the Bible, just because we don't have that much of a problem with it in this country. If we lived in Europe, certainly I would have spent more time on that. But I have done several shows on it, enough to show that that's a bunch of BS too, of course. How could it be otherwise, guys? It grew out of the same damn playbook, the same Jewish playbook. Of course Islam is BS, just like Christianity, just like Judaism. Look how much damage they have created across the globe. Just with that book alone. My God, man. Anyway, I did manage to finish these notes here. Anybody wants, you know, request a copy, I'll send them to you. Very interesting, though. So, that completes that discussion, and that completes, at least for now, my broadcasts. Like I said, you know, keep in touch and email. If and when I get back into broadcasting, you know, probably won't be more than maybe one show a week or something, but it'll be here on Renegade, if and when that ever happens. I'm hoping it won't be too long, but I don't know. I can't at this stage say anything for sure right now. But, you know, do keep in touch. Again, my email, truthhurtsradio@aol.com, spelling hurts, H-E-R-T-Z. I mentioned how, you know, there was a lot of other things I wanted to cover, but obviously didn't have time to cover, and that I would spend a few minutes going over some of these topics, which I might one day cover later down the line. But in the meantime, you know, if you wanted to check some of these out, I've got hundreds of them, obviously. I'm not going to be able to go through all of them, but I'll highlight just a few of them here. And if you want, drop me an email and I can send you the notes for them. I got one show where I go through, you know, beginning 3,500 years ago in ancient Egypt and continuing up into modern times, showing how one of the ways that the tribe has been able to infiltrate governments. Oh, they've had many ways, but one of them has been to become advisors to kings. That's been one of their most popular, most preferred methods down through the centuries. They would become an advisor to this, that, or the other king. In the meantime, fellow tribesmen over in this, that, or the other kingdom, you know, there were tribe members there that were becoming advisors. Later, they would meet secretly, conspire without their respective rulers knowing what they were doing, you know, behind the scenes. And then they would come back and give advice to the kings that they were, you know, that they had won the trust of. Advice based on what they conspired with their fellow tribesmen about the night before. And the king would think, oh, yeah, that makes good sense. That's going to be great for my country. And would follow that advice, not knowing he was walking right into their trap. So, you know, if you want those notes, very interesting. I go through a lot of, by no means exhaustive, but, you know, some of the main highlights down through the centuries of Jewish advisors to kings and the havoc that they wreak. I got another set of notes that I wish I had time to get to. I put a lot of work into this. It's got to be, I don't know, 40, 50 pages long. On Mr. Churchill. Oh, what an evil bastard he was, ladies and gentlemen. Do you have any doubts that that man was a scumbag? From the word go. Then, you know, request those notes. I'll send them off to you. Some think that he actually was a decent guy early on and then went off the deep end. Oh, no. Don't fall for that quote, even though it is a good quote and it's very true. The quote from the, what is it, the Sunday Times or whatever, where he talks about, he mentions the tribe by name. He talks about this conspiracy for world government, that it's Jews behind the scenes running the whole thing, you know, blah, 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 blah. Since the days of Weishaupt, or Spartacus, as he called, you know, that was his nickname. He talked about how all the great revolutions of the past century and a half had all been orchestrated, you know, by this group, part of their conspiracy for world domination. Yeah. The quote is, it's all true. It's a great quote. But he only said those things because there was a grand awareness at the time of the Jew problem. So he needed to make it look like he was on the side of the people and against the tribe, when in fact he was one of their biggest whores ever. He said it tongue-in-cheek, guys. He didn't mean one word of it. He was a piece of crap long before he made that statement. It was BS. Anyway, so if you want those notes, drop me an email. I'll send that to you. I had a two-part series on Dracula, or Vlad, and his tribal connections, which only makes sense because he was a bloodsucker and more ways than one. Genghis Khan, guys. Genghis Khan had tribal connections. Absolutely. Going back to the Khazarians. So if you want those notes. His conquest, guys, if he succeeded, he damn well near did. His conquest was on behalf of his tribal masters, just like Alexander the Great, damn it. I talked before about how he was receiving funding from the tribe. It wasn't a Greek or Macedonian conquest. It was a goddamn Jewish. But just like, American imperialism, it's not American. British imperialism wasn't British. Neither was Genghis Khan's, conquests, really his own efforts. It was the tribe behind the scenes. I was going to do a show on, the Great Pyramid in Egypt and a lot of the fascinating mystery surrounding that. If you want those notes, I have some notes on Rasputin. Definite tribal connections with Rasputin. I was going to do a show on the Sphinx. Did you know that the Sphinx apparently originally was an Anubis? It wasn't a lion-headed or a human-headed lion. It was an Anubis, but later, because of erosion or damage that was done to it, they reshaped it into a human face with a lion's body. But originally, it was, in fact, an Anubis. And I present a very strong case for that. It's a fascinating discussion. So if you want those notes, too, just drop me an email. Anyway, guys... as my mother always said, I never say goodbye, I say see you later. So, again, thanks to Kyle, thanks to Renegade, and I'm hoping to be back at least one show a week, not too long from now. But in the meantime, fight the good fight, folks. Fight it hard. Let's kick their ass. Take care, folks.
Tired of hearing all about Jews and their beloved Israel. This is America.
Hey, don't say that. Jews do so much for us and deserve our thanks.
Okay, so what do they do?
Although they are only 2% of the population, they are running our banks and overall monetary system, ensuring our children receive proper education and medication, entertaining us with TV, movies, magazines, and gossip, running some of our biggest corporations, including the big tech giants, weeding out awful hate speech, and promoting the rainbow of alternative lifestyles and gender identities, and funding the campaigns of our honorable and honest politicians.
Wow, they sure do a lot.
That's right. Don't be an anti-Semite. Let the chosen rulers of this world know you appreciate them.
Thanks, Jews!